Welcome back to the Fastest Known Podcast, where every Friday we talk with some of the fastest and, in this case, the most interesting people in the sport. I think we're going to hit a home run with most interesting people in the sport today, as now I am speaking with the originator of the famous Barkley Marathons and the Backyard Ultras. You know who I am speaking with, Lazarus Lake, a.k.a. Gary Cantrell, or the other way around. Welcome, Laz.
Well, good morning.
Well, it's good to talk with you. And I'm going to put this out there again as a postulate for the rest of this podcast. I think you have changed the sport of ultra running forever, single-handedly. I think you've had an extraordinary impact on the sport. And we're going to get into that. Let's start with the famous Barkley Marathons. My gosh. So in your words, what is the Barkley?
Well, as we said, it's just good, clean, fun, except it's not that clean and it's not always fun.
Well, no one is going to argue with that assessment, I don't think. Well, I think almost everyone knows, but it's supposedly 5 20-mile loops, although I don't think they are 20 miles. I think they're a little longer, but that's the nature of the Barkley. No GPSs are allowed. You have this very idiosyncratic approach where not that many people can get in. It's hard to figure out how to get in. It's hard to figure out even when it starts. Come to think of it, I don't know when it starts. Would it be appropriate to ask you when it starts this year, or is that too keptly, closely held of a secret?
Oh, no. It's public knowledge that it will start 1 hour after the conch sounds.
Okay, but the particular date of that conch sounding is not exactly on this big, splashy website, is it?
No, we try to operate as quietly as we can, because otherwise you end up with spectators, and it is not a spectator event. It's
right. No, you keep it pretty tight.
We try.
Well, speaking of which, how many movies? Isn't there like 3 movies? I get it mixed up. How many movies have been made on the Barkley?
You know, I don't really know. There are several. And then you've got to define what constitutes a movie. Lots of people have made little pieces about their experience. We'll have some media up there next year. It's kind of a compensation to the public at large that it's not a spectator event, so that gives people a chance to satisfy their urge to know what's going on, kind of like watching a train wreck.
Well, that's a pretty good metaphor. I think how many Barkley stories are there? Hundreds, thousands, but I think Gary Robbins collapsing across the finish line 6 seconds after, 60 seconds after 60 hours, but coming in from the wrong direction. What adjective do we put on this?
At the time, it was just really sad. And it's still really sad. That's sports. If you don't have tragedy, you don't have joy. And
that's a good point.
Barkley has a lot more joy than most, because it has a lot more tragedy than most.
That's true. Without consequence, what's happening really? There's a lot of races where they're really trying to get you to the finish line. Right. They just go all out, say, okay, everyone's got to finish. We'll shepherd you there. And of course, the aid stations are like next level. I could just eat every meal at these aid stations, but not so much the Barkley. It has this famously low finish rate. So you're not really trying to get people to the finish line. What could we ask are you trying to do? Is that a fair question?
It's a chance for people to separate themselves, especially today, from just being connected and be alone out in the wilderness and totally reliant on yourself. It's really in recent years become a rarity, and some people really struggle with disconnecting from all their devices and being completely cut off. There's often been a push to put trackers on the runners and say, well, you set them where the runners can't look at it to see where they are, but we can watch them from camp. But even that is connection. When you leave the starting line at the Barkley and head out in the woods, you are disconnected from everything. Assuming that someone would ever come look for you, they'll have to locate you.
Right. Well, I think I forgot what year it was when I think it was Dan Baglione. He wandered off and no one found him. I think he finally wandered back 23 hours later, wasn't it?
He went out and he passed the book checkpoint at 2 miles and never reached the next one. And he was gone for 32 hours. And we we were actually in the process of putting together a search when he came back into camp. He had wandered out of the park and off the map and was trying to figure out his location with things that were on the map because he wasn't aware he had wandered off of the map. So it's real trouble with your route finding by map if you wander off the map. He ended up being found by a couple of guys that were just up in the mountains in their recreational vehicle in another part of the mountains. And they took him, brought him out, and he went and ate breakfast. And he didn't think to call the park and say, I'm okay. So he ended up taking 32 hours to officially cover 2 miles when we were standing there, everybody hustling and bustling around and getting ready to start the process of a search. And he came walking up behind me and said, what's going on? What's all the excitement? Oh, yeah, it's a search for you.
Okay. Well, I think we'll make note of this. This could be a record. 32 hours for 2 miles.
Yeah, 16-hour miles.
I think I'm glad to hear 16-hour miles. That's a slow pace. But I think I'm happy to hear that you were going to go look for him. I hadn't quite done it yet, but you were gearing up to do a search.
Oh, we'll probably eventually search.
Listeners, if you're going to get lost, you would have eventually. Okay, so all hope is not lost. Well, when you started this way back then, I remember when you started it, I thought, and please let me know if I'm misconception here, I thought you were kind of thumbing your nose a little bit of ironic take at the community that seemed to embrace suffering sort of for the sake of suffering, you know, like suffering was a good thing. And you kind of like, yeah, you like suffering, try this, you know, sort of this in your face aspect to it. Am I incorrect on that?
It was just trying to introduce a genuine trail run to trail running, because trail running, as it is practiced here, is mostly path running. It's not trail running. It's what I thought of as a trail from all my years in the woods. You used a map and you patched together routes that used anything from animal trails to old logging roads and to get from one place to another. It was actually a privileged position within the Boy Scouts that where I really started my backpacking and camping, that they would take us, and we were just kids, and we'd take a map and figure out how did they would pick a place, and those of us who were pretty proficient would let us out to find our own way to where we were camping. It might be 5 or 10 miles away. And I can remember you'd have to do things like look at the Cumberland Escarpment, which is essentially a 200-foot rock wall that runs all the way from Alabama to Pennsylvania, and figure out from looking at the map where would be a place we can get up that. And so my thinking of trails when people were doing trail runs and doing 6-hour 50 milers and stuff, I thought, how the hell could you do that on a trail? So we just introduced real trails to trail running.
Gotcha. Which is your conception of what it was supposed to be.
Which is, yeah, that's of course, trail running, it's like good, clean fun. It doesn't involve that much running, and not everyone can see the trail. You have to practice your eye.
I gotcha. Very good. Practice your eye. Okay. Well, how about the idiosyncratic? That's a good explanation. I appreciate that. What about the idiosyncratic aspects, the $1.60 entry fee, the license plate? Was this in direct reaction to the hullabaloo, the, kind of the big show of the other races, or is that just your personality style?
It was just an amusing thing. The $1.60 was, at that time, the race fees were really rocketing up, and kind of a standard became $1 a mile. The really expensive races were $1 a mile, and which they're a little bit more than that now. And so we made it a penny a mile. And then since there's a 100-miler and a 60-miler, we charged $1.60. So we, you know, the smarter runners would have figured out that they were being charged twice for the same miles.
See? Okay. Gotcha. All right. Those are, there is an old cliche. One could say there's a method to your madness.
There's a reason for everything, and things just kind of build up over time. You come along, there were the license plates. That was something that's been quite a few years ago now, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. We always have some obscure item as part of the entry fee. And we thought it would be fun to get a home plate because people came from all over, get a license plate from their home state or country. And then when we got them, we thought, it'd be fun. We'd hang them outside a camp. And we sat there and looked at it and said, oh, that's really cool. If we kept doing that, well, if you keep doing that, you have hundreds and hundreds of plates eventually, and you have to go up a day early just to hang them all up. So.
You have to phase that one out.
Well, no, we're still doing it. We haven't figured out a good way to phase it out. The license plate display is really impressive.
Indeed. Gotcha. I like it. So there is indeed a reason for everything. It's not just random. Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Well, here's so Barclay, as I mentioned at the start, has achieved this, what's the word? Not quite mythical status, but epic status, in that it truly epitomizes one aspect of the sport, which is testing the limits of human endurance. I mean, people aren't really going for speed. Certainly not taking selfies out of the course. It's really been boiled down to, you know, literally the limits of human endurance. Is that, though, how you see it? That's how other people, I think, see it. But how do you see this event?
It is supposed to be a 1% race. And it's really a 1% of 1%, because the people that are entered are, if not necessarily the fastest, they're very experienced, very exceptional runners. They have a gamut of skills. You see a lot of people with alpine climbing background, a lot of orienteers and what is it, Rogaine? That's kind of a mix of, although it's not any of those things. There's a prescribed route, but you have to find it yourself. And so we get collect a bunch of really good runners and backwoods athletes and put them with a test where it's designed so that hopefully only about 1% will finish. And since you only have 40 runners, a 1% finish means that you won't necessarily have a finisher every year.
That's very good math. Wow. Thank you. See, well, here we go. There's a method to the madness, a reason for everything. I got that. But you're right. So that's every 2.5 years, someone might finish, so to speak, or twice every 5 years. Okay. And now the last person, however, was John Kelly. And that was a while ago. That was 2017. So, and you famously make the course a little harder when people are achieving a little bit of success. So has the course become too hard, or do you think someone else can still finish?
No, we change the course slightly every year so that it's always new. No one can get out there and from having run it before memorize it all. Of course, the park is of a limited size, so some sections of it have stayed for years and years. And we will make some alterations and some changes every year so that everyone has to be on the alert the whole time. And it doesn't necessarily get harder or easier. You're really looking to put it in pretty much the same place. The biggest reason we haven't had anyone finish is the concept of a pipeline, that there's a pipeline of potential finishers. Once in a long while, someone comes out and finishes the first try, but most of the time it takes multiple attempts. And we do sit and look at the field every year before the race has started. And you can kind of pinpoint people that you've watched them. They come and they make an attempt and they fail. They make mistakes or get caught with something they're not prepared for. And the barker is not the person that says, well, this is just unfair and unjust. They say, I've got to get better. And they go home and they alter their training, they alter their preparation, and they maybe even develop or improve different skills, and they come back and try it again. We had that period where that we had finishers like 3 or 4 years in a row. And the reason that we had them is those people had been in the pipeline for quite a while. And so they each finish. Most people, when they finish once, if they come back to try again, it's a terrible disaster, because you have to have a mindset that's so intense. One of the runners said it best. He said, I remembered that I could do it, but I forgot how hard it really was. And so we've got new guys in the pipeline, and there's some really good runners that'll be taking it on this year. And I think, hey, we've got a possibility of a finisher. I would say the weather has to cooperate, but we've had finishers in some of the worst weather years. it's a matter that things have to work out for them.
Right. The last few years, there has been some bad weather.
Yeah. A 65-degree drop in temperature during the second loop. Or either the second or third. I can't even remember which. I think it was the second loop. 65-degree drop. They left. It was 80 degrees and sunny. And by the time they were coming around on the far side, ready to make the turn towards camp, it was 15 degrees with 30-mile-an-hour winds, and they were in snow up over their ankles.
That's going to be a hard day.
That's hard for your body to adjust to.
Well, I did ask Jared a year or so ago, okay, Jared, has the course become too hard? Can someone still do it? He said, without hesitation, yes, no doubt. So he certainly confirms your approach there. Interesting. I like it. 1% in the pipeline. That's a very interesting term, because you do see a little history of mentors. You know, like there is, Brett Mauney and then Jared. And Jared kind of worked with John Kelly a little bit. You know, so people start following an experienced person for the first few laps. Last year, Jared went with Luke Nelson for a while. They were the last people standing. So there's also kind of a mentorship that happens, isn't there?
It's the Barkley is achievable now by a combination of community knowledge and then the awareness that it is possible. The skill sets that are involved, or the combination of skills. You didn't have people in the first years of Barkley that had put all those pieces together. And every time that humans approach a problem collectively, and there's almost like a genetic corporate knowledge that develops over time. The people now are very good at it. And then there's some other races that have come up around the world that have a similar, you can't really make a Barkley somewhere else because it's particular to the environment where it is. Those rugged mountains in East Tennessee and the forests and everything are unique. And they have one in France. Well, the Alps are much bigger and much more impressive. You have to have a very different race because it's tailored to that area. But the concept of throwing people out there by themselves, that's the real core of it. And so they get better from combining that knowledge, but when they're out there, they have to apply it entirely out of their own head. If this really even stays with the point that you were asking about. And then the other side is the belief it can be done. People were inching up into the fourth loop when Mark Williams came and finished the whole thing, and he came and he believed it could be done, and conditions worked out, and he was one of the rare people to do it his first attempt, and he never made it again after that one. But he was mentally and physically prepared, and the pieces fell into place, and he got it done. After that, then you know there's going to be more because people understand it can be done.
It's the 4-minute mile.
Yeah. It changes your concept of what's possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I'm pondering this, Laz. That's very interesting because, again, we have this irreverency of the license plate, the $1.60 entry fee. You can't figure out how to enter it anyway, versus this very hardcore, purist testing of the limits of human endurance and human spirit, we could say as well. I think rather than endurance, I think it's more like spirit, in my opinion, because when, you know, I was a little dismissive, to be honest. I said, I don't want to go and get my legs all scratched up and yada, yada, I don't want to do this. But then my friend Jared, as you know, really got into it. And, you know, he turned me around completely. So I really got the message then. And I realized that when he goes into that, he's at another level. It's not, there's no decision about whether to continue or not. If you have to make a decision, you're not going to do it. So the people who have completed it, that decision has been removed from their level of commitment, which in my opinion is dramatic. That's a remarkable breakthrough in how one approaches anything.
The people who are going to finish, you have a good idea who they might be the day before, because they have that 1,000-mile stare. They're there, but they're not there. They have come with such an intense focus on what they're going to do that they're just biding time. They're just waiting on the conch to sound so that it's game time. It's a common thing to every sport.
I think John
to the frame of mind that it takes to compete at the highest level. It doesn't matter if you're playing high school football or running the Barkley. To really succeed, you have to find that place in your head where that you are so intensely focused on what you're doing that you are better than you really are. Say you don't run the Barkley by running the very best you can run. You run the very best you can run in training. And then at the race, you have to find a place where that you're better than you are.
Wow. Yeah. And due to the sleep deprivation aspect and being out at night, generally by yourself, you have to be by yourself on the last lap. If you're made it to 5 laps, then you have to have taken the decision out of it. That there is no decision to make, that you are going to march forward.
Yeah, that's true. Now you see people there that have that mindset, but are in the end forced to quit. I mean, conditions make it impossible, but no, they don't make a decision. And I think that's really common to most ultras. If you have those races that have it's a 100-miler with a 50-mile drop down. You give people a drop-down option. It's like you're not their friend helping them finish. You're an enemy giving them a way out. I'll run to 50 miles and then decide. Well, I'll save you trouble. I know what that decision is going to be.
Okay, I like it. This is so fun because the overarching perspective here is this is really different. Your perspective as a race director is quite different than most race directors. And this is, I think it's coming to light why this has become so famous and so well known. John Kelly, as we mentioned, is the last to finish in 2017. But prior to that, he started that fifth lap. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And he did it. He got up. He marched off. He made it like 400 meters and just did a face plant. But he walked out of that aid station, didn't he?
Yeah.
So that was a sign of something to come the following year.
It's a lot of the people who finished have made it into the fifth loop and not made it and then come back to complete the task. You get incrementally stronger mentally and physically, and then in your skill sets, you keep refining yourself. So seeing the things that John has done, watching his growth from the first time he came to Barkley and he had his dad as a crew, and he stopped after the third lap because his dad thought that he might die. We try to tell him, you can get really, really tired and you're not going to just die. It's kind of frightening how much abuse your body can take if you're not breaking or damaging something, you're not going to die.
Oh, boy. Well, like you said, John went on to great things in the UK. He moved to the UK and he just won the, crushing the big roots out there.
Won the Spine this year, which is a huge, huge race of a like challenge level in the UK.
Yep. Well, speaking of finishing, something that is very interesting, become a tad controversial, is I think, correct me again if I'm mistaken, that you said a woman will not be able to finish five laps of the Barclay.
Math is against
which them. Now today's it's the 11 or 12% rule. Is that what you're going? Not rule, but 11 to 12% statistics.
The difference between the women's world records and the men's world records at just about every distance is that 11 or 12%. And if you take all the people that have finished the Barclay, Brett Mountie one time, I think, ran a fast enough time that someone could add 11 or 12% to it and still finish. It's going to take much more of an outlier from a woman runner than it does from men. If it's the 1% of 1% of men can make it, then it's probably 1% of 1% of 1% of women. We do have this year signed up a truly exceptional field of women. We've taken, if you want to get into the Barclay, the best way to get in is to be an exceptionally talented female runner, because we bump them. We have the privilege of getting to do what we please. So we bump women of that caliber to the very top. And I think there's 10 or 11, roughly a quarter of the field this year is female, and they're pretty much all exceptional. So we will get yet another look. We would like to see some woman do it just to put this to bed, because I get blamed for it.
You don't want to keep getting asked about it.
Well, people blame you. You know, that's like that somehow this translates to a hostility to women, that you just state the obvious. A woman hasn't been able to finish it. It's a course that requires a lot of speed and strength, and that doesn't really play to the averages of your populations of male and female runners. There's a reason that we have gender divisions. And so you just got to hope some woman can at least do it. But right now we'd be happy to see just another fun run. There hasn't been one since 2014, I think. A fun, just a three looper by a woman.
Right. Well, this year, coming year, could be it. Well, thanks for sharing that. So, like you said, you're going to let in whoever the heck you want to let in. And if a woman really has the chops, you know, has that reputation, you're letting them in. That's good to hear. There's only 40 spaces, so that's an extremely tight field. So it's just nice to hear.
Yeah, there's not 40 women in the world that could probably give it an honest shot. We might have the bulk of the women who can, and then other ones have been there. So most of those 10 spots were acquired the same way as normal. They've worked their way up and in, and then some of them are just some really exciting athletes that I'd like to see get a chance, and we'll see what they can do. Maybe they'll get at least a fun run.
We will. Thanks. Like you say, fun run is three laps. That's worthy. That's highly worthy. So hopefully a few people will get that done.
People are proud to get one lap. Once you've been there, I know they come a lot of times, and it's five laps or nothing, five laps or nothing, five laps or I failed. And they get done and say, that one time around, that was a hell of a feat.
they reset their expectations.
they reset their measuring stick for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for the heads up. We'll be, I can't say we'll be watching avidly. We'll be following avidly. 2022 will be a good year, hopefully, and hopefully no big snowstorms. So nice.
The weather is probably going to be bad because that time in the spring up at Frozen Head, it has its own climate. So it'll be something. It always does something.
Well, it is a lot neat. It only does something. So sunny, windless, and dry is not standard. What is a La Nina year, which means the Southeast is scheduled to get, or not scheduled, but statistically might get a little more precipitation this winter. But we don't know. Nobody knows.
Well, I hate when it rains the whole time. I think the important thing about weather is
you're out there too.
Weather that's good in camp. Good weather to sit around a campfire is important. And then the runners will have to deal with what they have to deal with.
Yep. Gotcha. Well, here's something that's I've wondered about. Maybe some other people have as well. So 40 people times $1.60 is $64, plus you give out $11 watches versus the New York City Marathon. That's at capacity 53,000 people paying $296 entry fees. That's $15 million versus $64. So, Laz, how does this work? I mean, what's up? I mean, what am I missing here? Or explain the mathematics, the economics of the Barkley Marathons.
It's not a real solid business model, but okay. But then that's the application fee. So I get $1.60s from more than just the 40 people who enter in, and we don't refund them. Your application fee is forfeit. Although there's people so incredibly cheap that they withhold the money pending getting entered, not realizing, of course, that lowers their chance of getting entered. The people who actually entered, we get things like a pair of socks or my white shirts. Something that I normally use and would otherwise have to go to the store because I don't like to come out of the woods if I can help it. So it's maybe not financially the best maneuver, but I get stuff I need and it saves me having to go to a store.
Gotcha. You have a lifetime supply of white shirts.
I hope so. I've got to find the box. It's time to put some new ones out. And
okay. All right. But obviously it's continuing. How about those movies we talked about earlier? Someone was making money on those movies. Do you get a commission on at least that?
No. No. I was actually surprised to find out people thought, well, you made money off the movie, right? No, I was just there and they just did it. I think Netflix probably made a lot of money off the movie. I don't think even the people who did the movie got rich off of it. But sure was a damn lot of people saw it.
Right. A lot of people saw it. It became famous. Interesting. Well, I'm pondering this, so at New York City Marathon's $15 million revenue versus your well, who knows, $200
or $90.
You know,
at least.
Okay. All right.
It could be up to 100 okay. sometimes. But it gives me great leeway to do what I want to do and not worry about what anybody else thinks is just or fair. Because
that's a good point. Hell? Good point. Now, you paid $1.60, dude. What do you expect?
If people have a complaint, they're supposed to write it out on a scrap of paper, put it in an old sock, and bury it under a tree in their yard.
Well, this is, again, I'm seeing the method to the madness here. That was a very good op. I mean, you say everything dismissively with a bit of sense of humor. But that actually is a good point. At this entry fee, you can do what you want. If you can blow that conch shell whenever you want, and what are people going to complain about? They just paid $1.60. So I like it. This is brilliant.
The only part that makes me feel bad about the conch shell is the media, because we do allow some media up there, and that is a point I want to make in a second. But I feel bad because they feel obligated to get their film or photograph or whatever of me blowing the conch. So unlike the runners who can wait until they hear the conch, or wait till the person in the next tent who is a Confederate to hear the conch and bang on their tent, they sit out there and wait all night long.
Oh, really?
Whenever you see the pictures or the video of me blowing the conch, be aware someone went the extra mile to make sure they did that. And they say, can't you tell us when the start will be? We won't tell anyone. We're not runners. And no, the runners are really, they're a pretty smart group. And they'll figure out if no media is up there waiting outside that the conch is not blowing anytime soon.
Oh my gosh. What stories you have, Laz. This is, like you say, you've created something that is blindingly simple, and in that simplicity, it can blow up, right? And if you create something that's complicated, you're almost in a box as you have to figure it out. By doing something that is uber simple, then everything becomes possible. So these stories are remarkable.
And the media, because people, the natural inclination of the runners, because of the kind of people they are, is to say, the media. But the media is not allowed out on the course. They're just there in camp. One reason they do such a good job is that there's such limited filming opportunities that they're like Alfred Hitchcock. They have to tell the story without displaying the blood and guts. And one thing that the Barkley, I like to think it operates as, it's in this natural area. And natural areas are very few. All the places I used to go backpacking as a kid, they're either a park or they're gone. You hate that it's a park with all the rules and restrictions. But if it wasn't a park with the rules and restrictions, it would be already destroyed. There's always pressure on those resources. I mean, Frozen Head has 80,000 acres within the park, probably 30,000 acres of timber that someone would like to cut. And the remaining coal and mineral resources that are inside. So there's always someone who wants access to that stuff, and it needs a constituency. You can't open it up to everyone who wants to come. We could put thousands of people out there every year, but it would be impossible, and it would destroy the wilderness. Wilderness is not for everybody, and it can't contain everybody. So the media is there to tell the story of what the possibility is. And I think to, well, obviously to every person, this concept of a man thrown alone into the wilderness to live or die, survive on his own merits, it has an appeal. And so all these people that follow the Barclay from home that have no dream, no desire to ever actually do something like that themselves. They see a value in the wilderness. And we need every place to survive needs a constituency. The people that try to preserve the wilderness by pushing everyone away, they're not going about it the right way. Because if you don't have a constituency, eventually someone comes in and says, hey, look at all that. Oh, how many board feet of timber are in Frozen Head? It's not going to ruin it if we cut all the big trees and take them out. It'll recover. They'll grow back. But I don't know if that's a coherent enough thought. But you see yourself, you do anything really worthwhile with a race like the Barclay or any of the really rugged races is try to convey that there's a value in wilderness and personalize it to people that are not actual direct users.
Gotcha. Good point. Well, that is John Muir, right? And I appreciate what you said, that sometimes people get in a very strongly restrictionist approach, lock it up, but that's bad tactics because you need a constituency. And that's what John Muir literally did, you know, over a century ago when he created the Sierra Club. He had this two-part process. One, take people out into the wilderness. Two, they come back and write letters to the congressmen to protect it. But if you don't have one, then two doesn't happen.
Yeah. And, we're lucky because that the park has responsibility for the resource of the natural area, which is, it's not now and hopefully never will be, have trails cut into it and vehicle access so that the handicapped ramp to get to the back corners of the park. But, and we can't possibly get in everybody who wants to go, but we try to pick people that will get value from the experience and also make good use of their spot. And then the media's job may be the most important there because they share it and let people that sit at home and watch TV see value in the wilderness.
Gotcha. Nice. I appreciate that. Well, continue. Thank you for that insight. Again, I think an overarching theme here is there's definitely method to the madness and switching into the backyard ultra. I started this podcast by saying you have changed the sport of ultra running forever. I think more than anyone else. There's obviously bigger races, more famous races, media, faster runners, et cetera, but what you have done, the sport of ultra running will never be the same again. Barclay, the way you've boiled down some human spirit aspects into this clear test is one example. But in my opinion, the backyard ultra could be your lasting legacy. This is the same type of situation in that what is really going on? Is this a race start? Whoever gets to the finish line first wins, and then you get your age group awards and you get your finishing medals and da da da. No. This is where everybody is a DNF except one person. So again, you've changed the game completely. So help us out on the backyard ultra. I'll ask you the same question. What is the backyard ultra?
It's a backyard race. You run 4.1667 mile course. Every hour on the hour, you have to be at the starting line and you have to go when the bell, you have to answer the bell. When the bell rings, you have to go. and you're on your own to complete that loop, because who the hell needs aid in 4 miles? It's relatively easy to run in an hour, but the hours keep adding up, and you have all kinds of things that are different about it. I've actually been asking myself, did we stumble across a whole new running sport? Because it's fundamentally different than other races. It's not like the time races where you're trying to get a maximum distance in a time, or the distance races where you're trying to cover distance in the greatest speed. It's a contest of the will to win. How many times can you walk to the starting line? There's one strategy that always determines the winner. Walking to going up to the starting line until you're the only one.
Right. Just like the Barkley, you've boiled down sometimes complex strategies and tactics into something that is just uber simple, and thus it opens up. You told, you didn't tell me personally, but you said one time, it's not won by the fastest person, the best athlete, and you don't quit when you can't go on anymore. You quit when you think you can't win.
Yeah. It's a lot of ways it hasn't turned out exactly the way I expected. The format was devised because we have this farm and we wanted to have an ultra on it. We tried a standard time run, set up laps on trails around this farm and the adjoining farms. And the restriction of space and resources. You say, well, all we've got is 140 acres, and we have the resources of an average American family. How can we have a really good ultra for our friends? And we put the format together, and then I didn't know if there'd be enough people to really want to do it. The first year, there were only 47 people in the world that did a backyard in one race. And that was in 2011 or 2012, 2011, I believe. No, 2012. So we've been 10 years, and now there's 300 and something backyard ultras in 65 countries, and you'll probably have 25 or 30,000 people at least that run a backyard, because they're fun and it's simple and easy. It's a nice grassroots race.
I think, thanks for that origin story, because I think me and maybe other people are trying to think, well, who is this guy? Is he just this brilliant genius who sees into the future, or because I think this is going to be a lasting legacy. I think you have stumbled onto a different type of sport with the backyard ultra.
There's a number of things. One is, of course, the athletes. It has its people this is what they're good at. You're really good athletes. Seems to be a really big crossover with like the 24-hour runners. The world-class 24-hour runners are mostly good at backyard. Some of them are not good at backyard at all. And then the guy who is just tough. You've been around long enough. You know those guys. They don't win races. They're not big stars because they're simply not fast enough. You run a race and the really fast guys run off, and they're not going to ever catch them. But they're just tough as nails and competitive. They do really good at backyard because you can't get rid of them. They're there every hour. They're back with you. And the other part, which was totally unexpected, is women win backyard ultras in a slightly greater percentage than the number of women who participate. Women do extremely well. You've removed the strength and the speed. I mean, it's something you should anticipate if you think about the way that the race is laid out. So I think, especially from talking to the female athletes, that for some of them it is, yeah, this is a release. Here is a sport where I don't need a women's tee. I don't need a women's group. I can run just to win, period. And nice. that is appealing to them. And you get to see, it took a few years to really manifest itself. There was like an invisible barrier. We would run at that Biggs backyard every year. You would have women among those last few. But I actually heard one of them verbalize it to their crew. They'd gotten down where there was only four people left. And she says, those men will never let me win. I said, no, you have to change your picture in your mind to, I'm not letting those men win. But once it's like finishing the Barkley, once women started winning and they realized they could, then Katie barred the door. And so last year in 2020, when we were, circumstances forced something on that we're going to continue because it works good. We had satellite national championships all around the world, 21 countries that were between restrictions and able to hold a race had national championships. 7 of the 21 national champions were women. And they weren't, and nice. We're not talking about just the, you know, Mauritius or some tiny country. We're talking about the Russian champion was a woman. The German champion was a woman. The American champion was a woman. The Canadian champion was a woman. They won outright. So it's really
nice.
Now the people that have trouble are the ones who are so committed to having a women's division that they have one, even though it serves no purpose. And what happens is there has yet to be, to my knowledge, any race with a women's division won outright by a woman. It's just like,
because they weren't motivated.
It's just like the 50 mile drop down in 100 that I say is not a favor to the runners. It's a attack on their ability to finish. That when you get in into the deep part of a backyard, there's some discomfort involved. And whenever you're working with discomfort, you've been around the block a few times. It's between your mind and you. You're the part of your mind that knows what you set out to do, that you want to do it. And the part of your mind that's saying, here's a good reason to quit. Here's a reason it makes sense. Here's this, here's that. And putting in a women's division is really handicapping the women. It's restricting their ability to get out there and just win. So I'm opposed to gender divisions in backyards. The numbers are significant enough now that you can see they can win. Don't take that away.
You described, of course, don't take it away. Well, Maggie Gutierrez, and then you mentioned the 1% of the 1% of the 1% might go by the name of Courtney DeWalter, who is both fast and tough as nails. So that's very interesting. The playing field has become equalized, so to speak, there. 7 of 21 national championships won by women. The other aspect about the backyard ultras, which I find is quite fascinating, besides the fact that everybody but one is a DNF, in terms of getting to a big number, it takes two to tango, doesn't it?
Yes.
If you have one standout, you don't go anywhere. Because as soon as you're the last person showing up, that's the last lap. You've timed out. You don't keep going. So it's an amazing how this simple little plan you've created blows up into this wide range of possibilities.
I've always felt like that was one of the more important parts of the whole thing, because in every sport, and I come from a sports oriented family and I'm kind of a sports oriented guy. You can never be better than the people you play. If you, you see teams that line up all weak opponents, wedge their way into weak divisions, and, or athletes that, that we used to call it cherry picking. I don't know what they call it now. They hunt around for races with weak fields so they can win. You can never be as good as you can be. You can only be as good as your opponent makes you. And the backyard is the only sport I know of that codifies that. When your last opponent is gone, you're done. That's, it doesn't matter if you have 85 yards in you. Matter of fact, the first two people that went 80, that went 81 and 80 in England last year, if either one of them had not been there, the other one would have won in 38 yards. So
laps.
They were, yeah. So they were utterly dependent on each other. And the athletes know that. So you at once want to see your opponents do well. And at the same time, you have to break them to win.
Right. What a mental game. I mean, like you say, you got to show up that starting line, maybe with even a smile on your face.
It's there's a whole lot of interesting things to it. The attachment that people develop when they're out there, especially when the ones where that they go for 19 or 20 or 40 hours as the only two runners, they become so tight. And you'll see one of them say, I'm done. The other one will say, no, you can go on. You can do one more. And then you can see the realization dawning in their mind that, no, if he doesn't quit, this never ends.
This never ends. There's, yeah, at least in 100 miles is really long. At least, okay, there's the finish line. You know, you can say, okay, you know, 14 miles to go. Okay, 8 miles to go. But in a backyard ultra, you can't say that. No. The tricks that your mind plays don't work at all.
Of course, the idea was in my head from a long time ago when I was young, because when I could run, this would have been a format that was well suited to me. But I have to wonder how I would have dealt with the part of not knowing when it ends. Because it was a particular strong suit in any of the things that I do, even doing the transcons now, to know where the finish line is. It doesn't matter if it's 11 more hours or 11 more miles. I can put my mind on that finish and endure a lot just to get there, because it's just only going to take so long. And when it's over, it'll be like it never happened, except it's just a memory. But when you know that the race could go another, it could go one more hour, or it could easily go 24 more hours. Or 36. The longest time,
right,
two people is like 43 hours. So you get down to the last two.
With just two people. Oh,
and
my
you
God.
Know, it could go two more days. If this stubborn bastard doesn't. Harvey yeah. said an interesting
wow.
thing.
Yeah, the mentality is.
During Biggs. And then this is something I don't think, I've not told anyone this story, but the runners, their minds are so fried at that point, and they get things stuck in their head that they worry about. The year Johan was worried that Jeremy Ebel was able to sleep while running, and therefore he would never be able to beat him. And then this year, Harvey said, he says, I'm a little concerned about the other two guys. he said that they're both hurt, you know, to in the way that you're, you know, you're not going to go to a hospital, but you're hurt and things are bothering you. He said, I'm afraid they don't have it in their makeup to go ahead and concede at some point. Just in his mind, you know, I'm going to go until they give up. But what if they break instead?
Wow. He actually cared about
that. That's the mindset you have to win, though, is that I'm going until no one else can go. When that
wow, well, you mentioned
when that doubt gets in your mind, when you start to think I can't win, there's no point going on. It hurts so bad. Why would you keep doing it if you're not gonna? If you know you're not gonna win,
that comes back to your quote: people don't stop when they can't keep running; they stop when they think they can't win. Well, speaking of you, in terms of this would have been in your wheelhouse back in the day. Well, it still is because the Biggs Backyard just took place a few weeks ago and you can't go to sleep until they go to sleep. So it's kind of you're still in it, aren't you? You're sitting there, you know, counting, you know, sounding little horn 15 seconds before the hour. And you got to keep doing that every hour, too.
As long as I can. The race could go on without me. But now it's just a point of pride that I know I can do 85 hours. So we will see if I can master the runner. Surely if a runner can run that 4 miles every hour and answer the bell, that I can just do all the other stuff that I do during the race and I can still answer the bell. I want to outlast the runners as long as possible. They're not making it easier though. 85 hours was a long time. And to be honest, I thought once that I had that I had missed an hour when I took the big sleep, the 15-minute one. I came out and I thought that I had, you know, I went to sleep and then got woke up and I had been setting my alarm. For some reason, I didn't wake with my alarm and got woken up. And so it was closer to the time that I had to be out there than I normally allowed. And so I rushed around and got out there and then I thought, if I missed the alarm, I must have missed an hour. So I asked them, who rang the bell the hour I wasn't here? And they said, no one. You've rung the bell every hour.
Okay. Your fates are inextricably linked.
It's a big challenge. But I'm really, you can improve the sleep aspect. I didn't think you could train for sleep. I thought you were either just born with a need for a lot of sleep or a need for very little. But you can get better at going for days and days on short naps.
Okay. All right. Well, you should know. You're the world leading expert.
I don't know if that should be a life goal for anyone, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask you, as I did on vis-a-vis Barkley, like you said, this has become a worldwide phenomena. You live stream championships, 25 to 30,000 people are going to be doing it. So pardon me for asking a personal question, but do you get a commission from this? I kind of have to stay with this theme of, you know, what's in it for you, buddy?
The Backyard Ultra. Well, the joy of most things is the joy of doing them. You just, for like the Barkley, for what it gives the people who run it, is the real value in it. To your job as a race director, in my mind, is to provide a venue for people to find greatness in themselves. It's not really about you, it's about them. And you're just some people would say an enabler, but there's probably a less pejorative term for it. But you're setting up opportunities for people to really shine. So you want to set the stage for them and let them take the stage and then step back. With the backyard, it started out just a thing to, so people could, that I knew could come to the house and we could enjoy the farm and enjoy my trails that I've built out there. When you see become aware of the potential, because almost immediately people were saying, hey, I want to put on a race just like that. Do you mind? Well, no, I don't mind. It's just an idea. You can't patent an idea. But we have trademarked it and we're trying to make a brand out of backyard, because I see the things it could be. It doesn't need to be necessarily just monetized. So we are seeking, we've got to put together an organization, and right now with all volunteer people, we've got these 300 and something races we've set up, championship setups, things for the athletes, so that you have the pleasure of saying, this is being run the way it should be run. Now, eventually you have to have some income for the people that are spending big amounts of time on it, because you have to justify the time. I mean, all the time I spend on the races I put on, I'm not some angel that does it for nothing. You look at it and say, you have to have some return to justify the time you spend, if for no other reason, because opportunity cost. And so we're looking for a sponsor, and we are having serious talks with someone right now about sponsoring the organization. And then in return, all you do is give them really high visibility. I mean, I would shamelessly promote getting the name of our sponsor out there, because if they sponsor the organization, then right now it costs nothing for a race to be affiliated. It costs nothing for a runner to be part of the backyard. Athletes that are vying to make it into the national championships and the world championships. And that's the way I want to keep it. And then we have people that, there's lots and lots of these races really are backyards, just like us. People that have the race, they have 25 runners, they set up out in the courtyard behind their house, run out the gate, do their loop on city streets and parks near their house. But yet they can be a part of the larger organization and spread the word. People can travel from here to there and run races. So the joy of doing it is a big part. I like to think backyard would be a valuable property at some point, but not for me. I'm too old that it's ever going to have any real return for me. The joy is putting something together after complaining about how these athletic organizations are run all your life, to have an opportunity to put one together and say, this is how it should be done.
Wow. Well, I started this podcast by saying you've changed the sport of ultra running forever, and you have described that. This is good. I mean, this is, I wrote down like 21 liners here. I could have written down 30 or 40, but that's good. And I'm very pleased personally to hear that you're setting up some sort of organization for the backyard ultras. And like you say, you can't, it's unsustainable to have many people volunteering their time in order to have the organization work and provide the services to the participants. There has to be a little support involved. So that's my opinion. So thank you for taking that into account.
Yeah, well, it has to be. I guess I could plug the www.backyardultra.com. And you can look up everyone, all the races worldwide that are affiliated are listed in there. And we're working on getting that catalog in good shape where you want to travel to Malta. There's a backyard ultra in Malta, and you could go over there and tack that on the front end of your trip and spend a day with people that are like natives to Malta. Having all of the social aspects of the backyard, which is one of the really strong things. Every hour you're together, the fastest runner and the slowest runner, they can get into conversation, spend a few hours running together. It doesn't matter, you know, as long as you're in within the hour. So you see an ability for people of all ability levels within the race to enjoy the social aspects of running instead of just the guy that's a quarter mile in front of you and the guy that's a quarter mile behind you. And
right. Good point.
So, and then we rank everyone that gets 24 hours or more, which is a 24-hour 100, which I think it's kind of the 3-hour marathon of ultras. More, I don't know that they're necessarily equivalent, but mentally, the 24-hour 100 is an achievement. So we rank for the year everyone who has done a 24-hour backyard. And there's the year, the competitive year starts August the 16th. And since then, there's already been, got to be close to 400 people now worldwide that have done 24 hours. So they covered 100 miles in a day.
Yeah, right. So the backyard ultras are a thing. Big time.
It's become a thing. You just sit back and look at it sometimes and think, this has got to be like a fantasy because I'm just an old hillbilly who lives in the woods. And it's a lot of gall to believe that I could have something where people are competing all over the world and you have national championships and world championships and all this stuff going on that I'll wake up one day and it won't be true.
Wow. Very, very self-effacing attitude. That's in a way, having such a simple, open attitude maybe is what's allowed some of these brilliant ideas to come forward. We've mentioned what's been in the past, but as I always do, what is next? I have to ask you this. 3 years ago, 2018, you walked across the country, which is, wow, that's quite an achievement right there. But so in part of the what's next, how is your health? I mean, are you going to keep hanging in there? I mean, what can you tell us about what's next for Lazarus Lake?
I don't know. I don't get younger and things don't get better. Matter of fact, you find out, and I know you probably are aware of this, when you're 18 and you do any damn thing you want to do and you get banged up a little bit, but you just heal. And then when you're 40 and 50, you find out none of that shit really healed. That it's just been biding its time to come back as the achy shoulder or the nagging pain in your back or some other manifestation. So, and then after that, of course, your career is on the downhill trend. But I feel like I'm in good health. I'm happy and excited about doing things. And as long as there's new goals, I've been invited to a number of backyard ultras in particular in different parts of the world. And that was where it dawned on me, what an incredible way to travel, because you go there, you're with people from there. It's a whole different way of visiting than getting on the tour bus and having a guy with a microphone tell you what you're looking at. And then the other best part is you say, what are cool places to go? What's the local food? What's the big thing that people do good here? And when you actually go see a place, you see it in a whole different way. You see it the way people that live right there see it, the things that they like to do. So I've been enjoying that. I've got another route for a Transcon that I want to do so bad. I just got to somehow squeeze out about 5 months to do it, because I'm never going to do one again as fast as I did the first one.
Ah, so you're planning on doing another walk across the country, but via a different route.
Oh, yeah. There's too much to see to go the same way again. And I made a lot of mistakes in my planning and preparation, my route layout. I learned a lot. I need to put that to use, or what a waste it would be.
Wow. Nice. This is you are embodying your spirit as a race director for yourself, learning, growing, and continuing to challenge yourself. That's really enlightening to hear.
Yeah. Well, you have two choices. You can set goals and pursue them, or you can sit around the house and wait to die.
Well, that's true.
I'm hoping death has to track me down.
Yeah, and you'll be out in the woods, since you might be hard to find. Okay. Well, on that note, I very much appreciate this conversation. I've learned quite a bit. And I think my proposition that you are one of the most creative people in the entire sport has been proven quite correct here. So thank you for giving us the backstory on how this has all come to pass.
It's probably some form of autism that makes me just not able to follow along and follow the design path. You just do things your own way because you're not smart enough to remember how other people have already solved those problems.
Well, very self-effacing attitude. I think it's probably a little bit more than that. And so I'm going to say, on behalf of everyone listening and everyone who's participated in your events and learned from them, thank you. Thank you. You've contributed a terrific amount to this sport and to this community, if you will. You're a pillar of the community, and I want to thank you very much for being a part of it and your contributions.
Well, I appreciate that. I have gotten a lot more from all the people that have come and run the races and from the community itself than I'll ever be able to give back. But that's life. You can't give more than you receive. People should try it sometime. No matter how much if you decide to give, you keep getting back and more than you give out. So the community has been very good to me, and I've become a better person from seeing all of the things that people that come to my races can do and have done and elevated just by being there, because I certainly never could achieve some of these things myself.
thank you again very much. And we'll see what happens at this year's Barkley.
Well, at least there will hopefully be a woman fun run. I think that there have been, in all the years of Barkley, there's been 15 finishers, and everyone's trying to be 16. In all the years of Barkley, there's been 11 fun runs by women, and only by 5 unique individuals. So the women with the fun run have a much worse track record than the men with the 100. So we've got the women that are going to change this and put this to bed.